As we wrap up 2025, one thing's clear. Uncertainty isn't temporary. It's the world we live in now. Noble Gold Investments helps Americans protect what they've built with real gold and silver, holding value when everything else feels uncertain. Visit NobleGoldInvestments.com and take your first step toward a safe future. This holiday season, when you open up a qualified account, you'll receive 10 one-ounce commemorative silver holiday coins. Visit Noble Gold today.
Past performance may not be indicative of future results. Investing in precious metals, including gold, involves risks. Consult with your tax attorney or financial professional before making an investment decision.
I used to love my morning coffee until it stopped loving me back. The bloating, the discomfort, it just wasn't worth it anymore. Then I found Everyday Dose, coffee with benefits. It's real coffee blended with mushrooms, collagen, and nootropics. Now I get my morning ritual without the crash or the discomfort. The Black Friday sale is on. Get 61% off your first coffee plus starter kit, a free A2 probiotic creamer, and over $100 in free gifts. Plus, you could win $100 cash or even get your entire order refunded. Head to everydaydose.com/podcast or use code podcast at checkout.
Section 33 of A History of the Papacy, Volume 1 by Mandel Creighton. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Read by Pamela Nagami. Book 2, Chapter 2. Deposition of John the 23rd, 1415, Part 1. Great was the tumult in Constance when at nightfall the flight of the Pope became known. The mob rushed to plunder the Pope's palace. Merchants began to pack their goods and prepare to defend themselves against a riot. Most men thought that the council had come to an end. The prelates who had spoken against John looked on themselves as ruined. Those who were zealous for the reform of the church saw their hopes entirely overthrown. But Sigismund showed energy and determination in this crisis. He ordered the burgomaster to call the citizens under arms and maintain order, and the Italian merchants saw with wonder the ease with which quiet was restored. Next day, Sigismund, accompanied by Louis of Bavaria, rode through the city, and with his own mouth exhorted all men to quietness and courage. He made proclamation that if John were fled, he knew how to bring him back. Meanwhile, anyone was free to follow him who chose. In a general congregation he held the same language, affirming that he would protect the council and would labor for union even to death. He accused Frederick of Austria of abetting the Pope's flight, and cited him to appear in answer for his deeds. The College of Cardinals chose three of their number as a deputation to John to beg him not to dissolve the council, but appoint proctors to carry out his resignation. The same day brought a letter from John to Sigismund. By the grace of God, we are free and in agreeable atmosphere at Schaffhausen, where we came unknown to our son Frederick of Austria, with no intention of going back from our promise of abdicating to promote the peace of the church, but that we may carry it out in freedom and with regard to our health. The needless lie about Frederick of Austria was not calculated to carry much conviction of the truth of the Pope's promises. Before the departure of the cardinals, the council, wishing to have a clear definition of their authority, so as not to depend entirely on the influence of Sigismund, requested Gerson, as the most learned theologian present, to preach upon the subject. Gerson's sermon on March 23, 1415, laid down the general principles that the church is united to its one head, Christ, and that a general council representing the church is the authority or rule, guided by the Holy Ghost, ordained by Christ, which all, even the Pope, are bound to obey. The Pope is not so far above positive law as to set aside the decrees of a council, which can limit, though not abolish, the Pope's power. The representatives of the University of Paris extended these principles of Gerson, and asserted that the council could not be dissolved, but might continue itself and invoke the secular arm against all who refused to obey it. Some went further than the majority would admit, and asserted that the council was in all points above the Pope, and was not bound to obey him. The cardinals now found themselves in a difficult position. They did not wish to break with the council. Yet so long as John professed his willingness to abdicate, they had not sufficient grounds for shaking off their allegiance to him. They thought it wiser not to be present at Gerson's sermon, though they were informed by Sigismund of its purport, which the three cardinal deputies, accompanied by the Archbishop of Reims, communicated to the Pope at Schaffhausen. Meanwhile, John had written letters to the University of Paris, the King of France, and the Duke of Orléans, explaining the reasons of his flight. In them he artfully tried to play upon the hatred of the French to the English and on the French king's jealousy of Sigismund. He complained that the English and Germans had leagued themselves together to carry matters with a high hand, and that Sigismund had tried to make himself master of the council. For these reasons he had retired to Schaffhausen, but was ready to accomplish his abdication and wished to journey through France on his way to meet Benedict. These letters were written to no purpose, as they were only referred back to the council. On the same day John sent to Constance a peremptory order to all the officers of the Curia to join him at Schaffhausen within 6 days, under pain of excommunication. 7 cardinals left Constance next day and went to Schaffhausen, as did the greater part of the Curia. On March 25th, the Archbishop of Reims returned with letters from the Pope to Sigismund, saying that he had gone to Schaffhausen merely for change of air, not through any fear of danger. He offered to appoint as proctors to accomplish his resignation, in case Gregory and Benedict also resigned. The whole body of cardinals, or 3 of them and 4 prelates, 1 out of each nation, of whom 3 should be empowered to act. But the council was full of suspicion of John and of his cardinals. It resolved to go its own way, according to the principles laid down by Gerson, and to pay no further heed to the Pope. So strong was the council that it refused to consider the reasonable difficulties of the cardinals, who felt themselves bound to hold by John until he openly set himself in opposition to the council. The cardinals, like all moderate men, who try to guide their conduct by ordinary rules in extraordinary crises, were regarded with suspicion by both sides. They were not summoned to the Assembly of Nations, held on March 26th, to discuss decrees which were to be submitted to a session of the council on the same day. The resolutions were only handed to them to read over before the session of the council opened. They demanded that the session be deferred till the return of their envoys from the Pope. They were told that Sigismund and the council were weary of subterfuges. They were in sore perplexity. A wave of revolutionary spirit threatened to sweep away Pope and cardinals at the same time. It seemed to some sufficiently dreadful that a session of the council should be held without the Pope, though for this at least the precedent of the Council of Pisa could be claimed. But it was an unheard-of innovation that the council should meet in spite of Pope and cardinals. The exclusive aristocracy, which had been willing to weaken the monarchical system of the Church, found that its own position was almost lost as well. Some of the cardinals at once retired to John. Many thought it wise to pretend illness and watch how events turned out. Only 2 determined to make a last effort to save the dignities of the cardinals from the violence of the council. Peter d'Ailly and Zabarella presented themselves at the session and succeeded in obtaining the respect due to their rank. D'Ailly celebrated the mass and presided. Zabarella read the decrees, which affirmed that the council had been duly summoned to Constance, was not dissolved by the Pope's flight, and ought not to be dissolved till the schism was ended and the Church reformed. Meanwhile, the council would not be transferred to another place without its own assent, nor should prelates leave the council till its work was done. A loud cry of placet followed the reading of these decrees. Then Zabarella went on to read a protest in behalf of himself and Dailly, saying that so long as John labored for the peace of the church, they must hold by him. They could have wished that this session had been deferred, but as the council determined otherwise, they thought it right to be present, in the hope that what was done would be confirmed by the Pope. The skillful and courageous behavior of the two cardinals saved the prestige of the sacred college, and prevented an irrevocable breach between the council and the old traditions of the church, which would have strengthened the hands of John the 23rd. On the same evening, the envoys of the cardinals returned from Schaffhausen, and next day, March 27th, before a general congregation, reported the Pope's offer to appoint the cardinals as his proctors, so that two of them could carry out his resignation, even against his will. He promised not to dissolve the council till there was a perfect union of the church. He demanded security for his own person and indemnity for the Duke of Austria. But the council was too suspicious of John to trust to any fair promises, nor did the attitude of the cardinals who had come from Schaffhausen tend to confirm their confidence. In the discussion that followed, some of them ventured to hint that the Pope's withdrawal had dissolved the council. They were angrily answered that the Pope was not above the council but subject to it. The suspicions entertained against the cardinals were increased by the fact that a copy of John's summons to his curia to attend him at Schaffhausen had been posted on the doors of the Cathedral of Constance, clearly at the instigation of some of the cardinals who had returned from visiting the Pope. The publication next day, March 25th, of a prolongation of the period within which they were bound to leave Constance, only increased the irritation of the council. Congregations of the nation set to work busily to frame decrees establishing the authority of the council without the Pope, and the cardinals, in alarm, saw the opinions of the most advanced advocates of the reforming party being adopted with enthusiasm by the entire council. In vain they endeavored to arrest the current of opinion by offering new concessions on behalf of the Pope. Sigismund should be joined as proctor to the cardinals, and the summons to the curia to leave Constance should be entirely withdrawn. It was too late. The distrust of John the 23rd and the cardinals was too deep-seated and had been too well deserved. Under the excitement of the last few days, the council had risen to a sense of its own importance and was determined to assert itself in spite of Pope or cardinals. John the 23rd, who was kept well informed of what was passing, grew alarmed at the turn which affairs were taking. Before the council had asserted its power, he thought it wise to remove himself to a more secure spot than Schaffhausen. The position of Frederick of Austria seemed precarious. The Swiss confederates were preparing to attack him. Many of his own vassals renounced their allegiance. Schaffhausen would not be safe against an attack. So, on March 29th, on a rainy day, John left Schaffhausen. Outside the gate he paused and caused a notary to draw up a protest that all his oaths, vows, and promises made at Constance had been drawn from him through fear of violence. Then he galloped off to the strong castle of Laufenberg, some 30 miles higher up the Rhine. He did not take with him even the cardinals who were at Schaffhausen, and they returned ignominiously to Constance, where they were received with decorous contempt. John had now thrown off the veil and justified the suspicions of his adversaries. His policy of chicanery and prevarication had been baffled by the resolute attitude of the council, and he was driven at last to try the chances of open war. The cardinals still desperately strove to check the alarming advance of the pretensions of the council. They saw, and saw rightly, that an unmodified assertion of the supremacy of a general council over the Pope meant the introduction of a new principle into the existing government of the Church. They threatened to absent themselves from the session to be held on March 30th, unless the articles to be proposed were modified. Sigismund offered to lay their views before the nations, and gave them vague hopes that some slight changes might be made. They prevailed on the French ambassadors and the deputies of the university to join with them in begging Sigismund to lay aside his intention of making war on Frederick of Austria. But Sigismund was inexorable. After much anxious deliberation, all the cardinals who were in Constance except Peter d'Ailly and the Cardinal of Viviers presented themselves at the session held on March 30th. Cardinal Orsini presided. Sigismund appeared in royal robes, accompanied by several lords and about 200 fathers. The decrees were given to the Cardinal Zabarella to read. They set forth that this synod, lawfully assembled in the Holy Ghost, forming a general council representing the Catholic Church militant, has its power immediately from Christ, and all men of every rank and dignity, even the Pope, are bound to obey it in matters pertaining to the faith and the extirpation of the present schism. So far, Zabarella read, but seeing that the words went on, and general reformation of the Church of God in head and members, he paused, and saying that they were contrary to general opinion, omitted them, and passed on to the next decrees, declaring that the Pope could not dissolve the council, and that all acts done by him to the detriment of the council should be null and void. The cardinals were willing to admit the supremacy of the council over the Pope for the immediate purpose of ending the schism, but they were not willing that it should extend to the matter which more closely concerned themselves, that of the reformation of the Church. In the tumult that followed his omission of the words of the decree, it was not sure how much he read afterwards. The session broke up in confusion, and the wrath of the council against the cardinals blazed higher. A pamphlet written by some German prelate attacked them in no measured language. They had been in league with the Pope against the council. Many of them had followed him to Schaffhausen and had only returned because they were not satisfied with the cookery there. Their character might be seen by that of the Pope whom they elected, a tyrant, a homicide, a simoniac, steeped in unmentionable vices. If they chose him as being the best among their number, what was to be thought of the rest? Yet the council behaved with dignity. It named deputies to confer with Zabarella, but it refused to reconsider the decrees themselves. On April 6th, another session was held in which the former decrees were again submitted and approved, on being read by the Bishop of Posen, with two additions, that anyone refusing to obey the decrees of the council might be punished, and that John the 23rd had enjoyed full liberty while at Constance. This last decree was an answer to John's plea on leaving Schaffhausen that he had fled from Constance through fear of violence. On this point, his cunning had overreached itself, as the moral force which a plea of coercion might have possessed was lost by his first excuse, that he left for the sake of change of air. He published a further allegation on April 7th that he fled lest the obvious violence to which he was exposed at Constance might afford a pretext to Gregory and Benedict for withdrawing their offers of resignation. John was much too plausible, and failed entirely to see that he could not establish his moral character in the face of Europe by putting forward pleas which no one could profess to believe. John was soon driven to feel his helplessness. On April 6th, the council besought Sigismund to bring back the Pope to Constance. On April 7th, the ban of the empire was issued against Frederick of Austria, and the excommunication of the council was pronounced against the disturber of its peace. The hope of booty made many willing to carry out the behests of the king and the council. Frederick, Burgrave of Nuremberg, led an army into Swabia, where strong towns fell before him, Schaffhausen, too weak to endure a siege, at once submitted to Sigismund. Another army was gathered from Bavaria and overran the Tyrol. Still, Frederick of Austria might have held out securely if the Swiss had maintained neutrality, as at first they intended to do in accordance with a 50 years' peace which they had made with Austria in 1412. But Sigismund urged that an engagement was not binding in the case of an excommunicated man. He held before them the prospect of increase of territory at Frederick's expense. He promised to make no peace with Frederick that did not guarantee their safety. The fathers of the council added a threat of excommunication if they did not lend their aid to the cause of the church. Then the scruples of the Swiss were overcome. They poured their levies into the Austrian possessions and advanced victoriously to the walls of Baden. On another side, the Pfalzgraf Louis overran Alsace. Frederick of Austria in Freiburg, where he had fled for safety, received nothing but messages of calamity. John the 23rd himself went to Freiburg on April 10th and was convinced that he could gain aid from the Duke of Burgundy. He strove in vain to encourage Frederick to hold out till succors came. He placed all his treasury at Frederick's disposal, promised him the aid of Italian condottieri, held out hopes of help from Venice and Milan, if Frederick would but resist for a time. But Frederick's spirit was broken. He thought only of making his peace on any terms with Sigismund, and regarded John's person as a valuable pledge by which he might appease the storm which he had drawn upon his own head. Meanwhile, the council went its way with stately decorum. On April 17th, a general session approved a letter addressed to all the kings and princes of Europe, recounting the circumstances of the Pope's flight, dwelling upon his entire freedom of action at Constance, lamenting the fortunes of the church under such an unworthy shepherd, announcing the intention of the council to send envoys to demand John's return. The council appointed as its envoys Cardinals Filastre and Zabarella, and drew up a document for John to sign, appointing proctors to carry out his resignation. John was to be required within 2 days to return to Constance, or take up his abode at Ulm, Ravensburg, or Basel, till his resignation was accomplished. In this session also the ill-concealed hatred against the cardinals found expression in a proposal to exclude them from the sittings of the council. A memoir, probably written by Dietrich of Nîmes, was read, arguing that if the object of the council were the reformation of its head and members, that is, the Pope and the cardinals ought not to be judges in their own cause. By their election of John the 23rd, they had sufficiently scandalized the church, and had shown themselves ready to aid him in thwarting the council. No conclusion was come to on this point, but we see how high feeling must have run by the fact that the council found it necessary to forbid the publication of libelous or defamatory documents under pain of excommunication. End of section 33. Section 34 of A History of the Papacy, Volume 1, by Mandell Creighton. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain, read by Pamela Nagami. Book 2, Chapter 2. Deposition of John the 23rd, 1415, Part 2. Next day, April 18th, the cardinals presented a series of propositions affirming the authority and headship of the Roman Church over a general council. Even over the universal church, the Roman Church, or the Pope, has authority immediately from God as much as a general council. Indeed, the Roman Church forms the principal part of a general council, over which the Pope presides, and in his absence the cardinals. Without the assent of the Roman Church, nothing could be decided by a council. The theologians set themselves to answer this document clause by clause, but we see that they were hard-pressed in doing so. Throughout the discussions of the last 30 years, the arguments in favor of a council had owed their force to the schism and its evils, had been founded on a plea of present necessity. But the arguments against schismatic popes lost much of their power when applied to the United College of Cardinals. The advocates of the council had been enabled to set up the claims of the Universal Church against those of the Roman Church, because the unity of the Roman Church was destroyed by the doubt as to its head. But no one ventured to impugn the validity of the position of the College of Cardinals, and when they asserted themselves as the rightful representatives of the Roman Church, and took their stand upon its privileges, the theologians of the council were in a strait. They answered the pleas of the cardinals hesitatingly, rather carping at the expressions used than venturing to attack the conclusions. The Church of Rome, they admit, is head of all the churches, yet not for the sake of nourishing schism. There is a difference between a council summoned to decide matters of faith and one summoned to extinguish a schism caused by the cardinals themselves. Whatever power the cardinals might have in the first case, they ought not in the second case to judge their own cause. We see in this the weakness of the conciliar argument. Taking advantage of a disputed succession in the papal monarchy, it attempted to raise, in a time of anarchy, a cry for a representative system in the government of the church. Against the distracted monarchy, it could make good its position. But when the nobles of the court asserted in their own defense the principles on which the monarchy was founded, the advocates of the representative system did not dare directly to dispute them. The council did not decree the exclusion of the cardinals, but practically they were rendered powerless by the fact that the conclusions of the assemblies of the nations were only handed to them a short while before the sessions of the council, so that they had no time to influence the final decisions. On May 2nd, they demanded the power to organize themselves like the nations, urging that the English nation was only represented by 20. The council, however, refused and bade them each join their own nation. Finally, at the session on May 25th, we find the College of Cardinals ranking by the side of the nations, though the understanding between them was never cordial. On April 19th, the cardinals Filastre and Zabarella left Constance to bear the council's proposals to John the 23rd. They found that he had left Freiburg for Breisach, still holding to his plan of drawing nearer to the territory of the Duke of Burgundy, who he hoped would send an escort to conduct him to Avignon. But with the fate of Frederick of Austria before his eyes, John of Burgundy hesitated to incur the hostility of the council. John the 23rd remained at Breisach, where the envoys found him on April 23rd, and laid before him the council's demands. John promised to answer them next day, but next day they learned with astonishment that he had fled in the early dawn to Neuenburg. The envoys accordingly retraced their steps to Freiburg, where, to their surprise, they again found the Pope on April 27th. John the 23rd's course was now run. Frederick of Austria had taken the first steps toward reconciliation with Sigismund, and knew that for this purpose he must be prepared to deliver over John to his foes. John was accordingly summoned by Frederick to take refuge in Freiburg for greater safety, and with a heavy heart was compelled to obey. There he had to listen again to the demands of the envoys of the council, and sullenly answered that he would send his proctors in a few days. On the return of the legates to Constance, April 29th, it was resolved to cite John to appear. Next day, Frederick of Austria came humbly to Constance to beg Sigismund's forgiveness, and John's proctor, bearing his demands and reservations, was not thought worthy of notice. The council was now omnipotent and determined to give John the 23rd no quarter. In a session on May 2nd, a citation was issued summoning him to appear and answer charges of heresy, schism, simony, maladministration, waste of church property, and scandals caused to the church by his life and character. On May 4th, the citation was affixed to the gates of Constance, and next day, the humiliation of Frederick of Austria before Sigismund gave the council a foretaste of its triumph. In the refectory of the Franciscan monastery, Sigismund sat on his throne surrounded by deputies of the four nations and the ambassadors of the Italian states who were present in Constance. The Duke of Austria was introduced as a humble suppliant by Frederick of Nuremberg and Louis of Bavaria, who in his behalf supplicated for pardon and submitted his lands and person to the royal grace. Sigismund asked Frederick if he assented to this prayer. On bended knee, with broken voice, Frederick repeated his request for mercy. Sigismund raised him from his knees, saying, "I am sorry that you have brought this upon yourself." Then Frederick swore fealty to Sigismund, resigned his lands into Sigismund's hands to hold at his good pleasure, promised to bring back Pope John to Constance, and to remain as hostage till his promises were fulfilled. The heart of Sigismund swelled with pride at his triumph. Turning to the Italian ambassadors, he exclaimed, "You know what mighty men the Dukes of Austria are. See now what a German king can do." It was a pardonable boast, and Sigismund deserved a triumph for his skill in seizing the opportunity of raising the dignity of the empire on the weakness of the church. The council did not entirely trust to Frederick's power of bringing John to Constance. On May 9th, the Burggraf of Nuremberg, with 300 armed men, escorted to Freiburg envoys of the council who begged John to return. John put a good face on the matter and professed his readiness, but took no steps beyond sending a secret commission to the cardinals Dailly, Filastre, and Zabarella to act as proctors in his defense. After some hesitation, they refused to act on his behalf. And the council in session on May 13th ruled that the citation had been addressed to him in person and that he was bound to appear himself. Next day he was condemned for contumacy and was declared suspended from the papal office. Commissioners were appointed to examine witnesses and draw up charges against John, and they were not long in discharging their office. A terrible list of 70 articles was drawn out against John, though these were for very shame reduced to 54 before they were laid before the council. They covered John's whole life and left him no shred of virtue, no vestige of reputation. From the days of his youth, he was steeped in vice, of evil disposition, lying, disobedient to his parents. Each step in his career had been gained by underhand means. He had poisoned his predecessor, had despised the rites of religion like a pagan, was an oppressor of the poor, a robber of churches, stained by carnal indulgences, a vessel of every kind of sin. Besides these general terms of abuse, the specific charges against him range from incest to an offer to sell the Florentines the sacred relic of the head of John the Baptist, belonging to the monastery of San Silvestro at Rome. Amidst this overwhelming mass of accusations, there is only one thing of which we feel convinced, that John certainly had the power of inspiring deep animosity. Meanwhile, John himself was brought by Frederick of Nuremberg to Radolfzell, 8 miles from Constance. He refused to go any further. His spirit was broken, and he was only anxious to escape the shame of a personal humiliation. He was accordingly left at Radolfzell, strictly guarded. On May 20th, envoys of the council announced to him his suspension from the papacy and demanded the insignia of his office, the seal, and the fisherman's ring. John submitted with tears and expressions of contrition. On May 25th, the articles against him were laid before the council, with a statement of the number and nature of the witnesses on each head. They received the solemn approval of a proctor nominated by each nation. The council was terribly unanimous. Even the contest with the cardinals was laid aside, and the college at last was allowed to organize itself as a nation, for we find the cardinal of Viviers acting as proctor to convey the assent of the college. Five cardinals were sent to announce to John that his deposition was imminent. John did not trust himself to reply in words, but handed them a writing, in which he declared that he was willing to submit to the council in all things, and would not object to its decision, whatever it might be. He only asked them to respect his honor and person. The council was gratified by this unqualified submission, but thought it well to take all precautions. Next day, five commissioners were sent to carry to John the articles on which he was accused, and summon him to answer in person if he thought fit. John refused to read the articles, and repeated his previous answer, that he submitted to the council, which could not err. In its infallibility was his one defense. He only asked that his honor be spared as much as possible. He sent a letter to Sigismund, his only hope after God, reminding him of their past relations, begging him, by the bowels of compassion of Jesus Christ, to be mindful of your plighted word, by which you gave us hope, and entreating him to use his influence with the council on the side of mercy. John's submission disarmed the extreme bitterness felt against him, and the sentence of deprivation pronounced against him on May 29th was couched in much milder terms than the articles would have warranted. It set forth the evils with which John's flight from Constance had threatened the unity of the church, and then proceeded, "Our Lord Pope John was moreover a notorious simoniac, a waster of the goods and rights not only of the Roman Church but others, an evil administrator both of the spiritualities and temporalities of the church, causing notorious scandal to the Church of God and Christian people by his detestable and unseemly life and manners, both before and since his accession to the papacy. In spite of frequent monitions, he persisted in his evil course, and therefore is now deposed as unworthy, useless, and harmful. All Christians are freed from their allegiance, and are forbidden to recognize him any longer as Pope." After the deposition of John, care was taken for the future by a decree that no new election should be made, in case of vacancy, without the express consent of the council, and that none of the three contending claimants should be re-elected. A solemn procession of the whole council round the city of Constance celebrated this final assurance of their triumph. The deposed Pope, now called once more by his former name of Baldassare Cossa, was brought for safe keeping into the strong castle of Gottleben, close to Constance. But there was a suspicion that some discontented spirits had again opened correspondence with him, and Sigismund handed him over to the custody of the Pfalzgraf Louis, who held the office of protector of the council. Louis sent him to the castle of Heidelberg, where he remained so long as the council sat, attended only by Germans, whose language he did not understand, and with whom he communicated only by signs. Thus fell John the 23rd, undefended, and it would seem, unpitied. Nor has posterity reversed the verdict of the council. Yet it is difficult not to feel that John had hard measure dealt to him in the exceptional obloquy which has been his lot. Elected to the papacy in return for his signal services in the Council of Pisa, he was ignominiously deposed by the council which claimed to be the continuation of that of Pisa. Here as elsewhere, the revolution swallowed up its own child, and John's character has met with the fate which always befalls those whom everyone is interested to malign, and no one is interested to defend. In his early career, he established his reputation for courage and political sagacity by his administration of Bologna, but his capacities were those of a soldier of fortune, and few looked upon him seriously as a priest. As the chief man in North Italy, he had it in his power to dispose of the fortunes of the Council of Pisa, and the cardinals could scarcely help rewarding him for his services by the gift of the papacy. But in his exalted position everything went amiss with John, and his entire want of success in Italian affairs compelled him, sorely against his will, to appeal to the sympathies of Christendom. His previous training in a life of military adventure made him light-hearted in running into danger. His entire ignorance of the religious feeling of Europe made him utterly unable to cope with his danger when once it gathered round him. It was one thing to play off against one another condottieri generals and win by trickery the towns of Forlì and Faenza. It was another thing to guide the deliberations of an assembly of theologians profoundly convinced of their own powers. John had neither learning nor moral character to enable him to hold his own in the face of the council. He had nothing but intrigue, which he managed so ill as to make it impossible for anyone to hold by him through respect for the papal dignity. Betrayed first by Sigismund and then by Frederick of Austria, he lost all self-command and self-confidence. When force of character rests neither upon moral nor intellectual principles, it rapidly decays under adverse circumstances. When John found that his first endeavors to manage the council were unsuccessful, he began to lose his nerve, and then blundered more and more lamentably. The council took advantage of each of his mistakes, and drove him remorselessly from point to point. John contested each point in detail with the weapons of mean subterfuge, and thus entirely ruined his prestige in the eyes of Europe. Everything went against him, and when he fell, there was no one interested to save him or even to give him shelter. Everyone felt that such a man never ought to have been elected pope. He was nothing more or less than an Italian military adventurer, and his camp life had been scandalous enough to make any stories against him sound credible. Yet it was not to the moral indignation caused by his character that John the 23rd owed his fall, but to the policy of Sigismund and the council, who were bent upon restoring unmistakably the outward unity of the church. When John threw difficulties in the way of their plan of a common abdication of the three contending claimants of the papacy, a civil war followed, in which victory declared against John. His rebellion was signally punished, and it was necessary not only to depose him, but to render it impossible for anyone to revive his claims. John had few friends, and they could do nothing for him. The council was omnipotent, and suddenly applied to him a moral standard which would have condemned many of his predecessors. At Constance, every tongue and pen was turned against John. A calm Italian observer blamed John for trusting himself to a council composed of turbulent spirits who wished to turn the world upside down. He admired his versatility and capacity. In his youth, a student, he afterwards distinguished himself greatly as a general and administrator. Unfortunately, he meddled in ecclesiastical matters which he did not understand, and his ability was forgotten in the contemplation of his misfortunes. This seems to have been the prevailing opinion in Italy. Cosimo de' Medici, who was not likely to befriend an utterly worthless man, retained both affection and respect for the deposed Baldassare Cosa, and gave him shelter in his last days. Still, it must be admitted that whatever good qualities John possessed, they were useless to him as pope, and his ignorance and heedlessness of the spiritual duties of his sacred office gave the council a handle against him. No remorse was felt in making him a victim to the zeal for the union of the distracted church. End of section 34. Section 35 of A History of the Papacy, Volume 1, by Mandell Creighton. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Read by Pamela Nagami. Book 2, Chapter 3. Religious Movements in England and Bohemia. When the dispossessed Baldassare Cosa was taken as prisoner to the castle of Gottlieben, there was another prisoner of the council within its walls, a Bohemian priest, John Huss, who was accused of heresy. At the beginning of the council it had been a question keenly disputed whether the promotion of the unity or the purification of the faith of the church should take precedence. Both matters had in some degree progressed, and the two prisoners at Gottlieben, Cosa and Huss, were witnesses of the two sides of the council's energy. The form of heresy which engaged its attention was one with which the council might have been expected to feel some sympathy, for it had its root in a deep-seated moral repugnance to the existing abuses in the ecclesiastical system, and a longing for their reform. It had the same aim as the council itself. But though men were all convinced of the need of reform, they differed widely in the basis which they were ready to adopt. Abuses were so widespread that everyone wished to remedy them, but some merely wished to remove the abuses of the existing system, others wished to remodel the system itself. The system of the church had grown with the life of Christendom, and the individual Christian recognized his religious life as forming part of the corporate life of the church. So far as the ecclesiastical system, under the political exigencies of the papal monarchy, had strayed from its original purpose, and threw stumbling blocks in the way of the spiritual power of the church itself, so far were the fathers of the Council of Constance anxious for reform. But the troubled times of the schism and the misuse of the papal power drove others to criticize the nature and basis of the ecclesiastical system itself, and had led them to the conclusion that it was inadequate to the needs of the individual soul, and ought to be reorganized on a new basis. The leading spirits at Constance were eager to reform the church system, but they looked with horror on those who wished to create it afresh. Part of the work which they had before them was the extirpation of the errors of Wycliffe and Huss, was the purification of the faith of England and Bohemia. We have spoken of Wycliffe in the three phases of his career as an upholder of the rights of the kingdom against papal aggression, as a reformer of the morals of the clergy, and as a critic of the system and doctrine of the church. In the first phase, all Englishmen went with him. In the second, he was in accord not only with the best minds amongst his own countrymen, but with the best minds in Europe. But when he attacked in unmeasured terms the foundations of the ecclesiastical system, it was felt that he threatened the existence of the church and even of civil society. It must be owned that the moral sense of the individual was set up by Wycliffe in dangerous superiority over law, and that his dialectical subtlety led him to indulge in theories and maxims which were capable of wider extension than he intended. We cannot be surprised that the English hierarchy set their faces against Wycliffe's teaching, and did their utmost to put down a movement which menaced their own existence. After Wycliffe's death, the party of the Lollards, or Cantors, as they were called, formed a compact body and grew in numbers and influence. They had always been favored by the discontented gentry, and numbered among their adherents several men of rank. In 1395, during Richard II's absence in Ireland, the Lollards presented to Parliament a petition for the reform of the church, in which they expressed themselves with astonishing boldness. They set forth the decay of the church owing to its temporal grandeur and the consequent corruption of the clergy. The ordinary Roman priesthood, it set forth, is no longer the true priesthood ordained by Christ. The pretended miracle of the Mass leads men to idolatry. The enforced celibacy of the clergy causes immoral living. The use of needless benedictions and exorcisms savors of necromancy rather than theology. Prayers for the dead are merely means of gaining alms. Auricular confession only exalts the pride of the priest. Pilgrimages to deaf images and relics are akin to idol worship. Monastic vows lead to much social disorder. War and homicide are contrary to the law of Christ, and occupations serving only for luxury are sinful. Inasmuch as the Church of England has gone astray in these matters, following its stepmother, the Church of Rome, the petitioners pray for its reformation and restoration to primitive perfection. We have here a plan of social as well as ecclesiastical reform, founded upon Wycliffe's principles and expressed for the most part in Wycliffe's language. So important did Richard II consider this movement to be that he hastily returned from Ireland and demanded from the chiefs of the Lollard party an oath of abjuration of their opinions. They seem to have given way at once, a proof that the movement had amongst its most influential followers no real meaning, but expressed rather general discontent than any scheme which they seriously hoped to realize. The petition of the Lollards naturally awakened the indignation of the leaders of the clergy. In 1396, Archbishop Courtney, who had shown little or no disposition for repression, was succeeded by Thomas Arundel, who resolved to take vigorous measures against the insolence of the Lollards. At a provincial synod held in February 1397, 18 propositions of Wycliffe were condemned. They were drawn from the Trialogus by some learned member of the University of Oxford, which was now anxious to restore its reputation for orthodoxy. The condemned propositions consist of 10 which tend to weaken the sacramental system of the Church, 5 which disparage the clerical order, and the legitimacy of temporal possessions by the Church. The other 3 assert the superiority of Scripture over ecclesiastical tradition, the moral basis of authority, and the philosophic doctrine of necessity. Not only did the ecclesiastical synod condemn these doctrines, but a trained controversialist, a Franciscan friar, William Woodford, wrote a refutation of them at the archbishop's bidding. Archbishop Arundel had thus prepared the way for stringent measures against the Lollards. The clergy condemned them, the learned refuted them. But before he could strike a blow, he was himself stricken. Political questions swallowed up ecclesiastical disputes. The nation was too busy with other things to attend either to the Lollards or to the clergy. The Earls of Arundel and Gloucester were put to death. The Archbishop himself was impeached by the submissive Commons and was condemned to banishment. Pope Boniface IX did not choose to quarrel with the king about an archbishop and translated Arundel to the See of St. Andrews. But Richard II's triumph was short-lived, and Arundel took a leading part in the events which set Henry of Lancaster upon the English throne. Under Henry IV, Arundel was more powerful than ever, and was resolute in his hostility to the Lollards. Public opinion seems to have turned decidedly against them, for many of their chief supporters had been staunch adherents of the fallen tyrant. Henry IV was greatly indebted to the help of the clergy for his easy accession to the throne, and had many promises to fulfill. He was poor and needed money. He was weak and needed political support. He was, moreover, fervently orthodox, and may not have been sorry to dissociate himself at once from his father's unworthy intrigues with the Lollard party. Accordingly, in 1401, a petition was addressed to the king by the clergy, praying for legislative measures against the Lollards who escaped ecclesiastical jurisdiction. The petition received the assent of kings, lords, and commons, and a clause was inserted in the statute for the year, enacting that a heretic convicted in a spiritual court was to be handed over to the secular arm to be burnt. Immediately after this, a Lollard preacher, William Sauter, met his doom as a heretic. The country as a whole had now pronounced its opinion against Lollardism, which henceforth became more and more an expression of political and social discontent, and lost much of its religious meaning. In 1406, another petition was presented to Parliament setting forth that the Lollards were dangerous to public order in matters temporal and spiritual alike. They disseminated disquieting rumors and aimed at upsetting the peace of the kingdom. No fresh steps were taken, but the revolutionary attempt of the Lollard leader, Sir John Oldcastle, at the beginning of the reign of Henry V, led to a more severe act against Lollardism in 1414. By it, the secular power was empowered to inquire after heretics, and on suspicion hand them over for trial to the spiritual courts. From this time, Lollardism gradually disappeared. The French War found employment for adventurous minds. Political parties afterwards had many grounds for contention, without sheltering themselves behind religious factions. The thirst for free inquiry died away in the universities. England entered upon a career of administrative helplessness and personal selfishness in high places, which left no room for discussion of abstract principles. The smoldering discontent with society into which Lollardism passed away still lingered, and at times blazed forth, but it had none of the elements of a serious religious movement. The teaching of Wycliffe produced no deep impression in England. Partly this was due to his own character. Wycliffe was a keen, acute dialectician, but his spirit was too critical, his teaching too negative, to inspire deep enthusiasm or supply a position round which men would rally to the death. Wycliffe himself had none of the spirit of a martyr, and his followers were ready to recant rather than to suffer. The movement was in its origin academic rather than popular, and was used at once for party purposes, from the traces of which it never quite escaped. It lent colorable countenance to socialist doctrines, and awakened hostility as being subversive to society. In short, its force was frittered away in various directions. There was no great national interest with which it decidedly identified. Perhaps the condition of English politics was unfavorable to a great religious movement. There was no decided popular party, no place for political action founded upon broad principles. Still, though Wycliffe set in motion no great movement and left no lasting impression of his definite opinions, he did much to awaken controversy, and by his translation of the Bible, he spread among the people a knowledge of the Scriptures. He thus prepared the way for the testing and reception of new opinions in the 16th century, and it is not an exaggeration to date from the time of Wycliffe that reverence for the exact words of Scripture which has always been the special characteristic of English religious life. The immediate importance of Wycliffe in the history of the world lies in the fact that in the remote country of Bohemia, his writings became one element of the first great national movement toward a new religious system. There was much in the early traditions of the Bohemian kingdom to dispose it to revolt from the papal dominion. The history of Bohemia was that of a Slavonic tribe thrown into the midst of German peoples. The wave of German conquest flowed around it, and it saw in the Holy Roman Empire merely a means of extending the power of the invading Germans. Christianity came to Bohemia from two sides, from Germany and Byzantium. But the Slavs listened to the preaching of the Greek monks Cyril and Methodius, though the papacy reaped the fruit of these conversions and behaved wisely in humoring the prejudices of the new converts. Moravia was made into a separate diocese, and the use of a Slavonic liturgy was allowed. The German church resented this ecclesiastical organization of the Slavonic peoples, and the cohesion of the Slavs was soon destroyed by the terrible invasion of Magyars, which severed the Slavic peoples and left Bohemia a helpless prey to German influences. The liturgy of Cyril and Methodius was suppressed and gradually disappeared, though it lingered in some obscure places to the middle of the 14th century. In its very origin, Latin Christianity in Bohemia was forced upon the unwilling Czechs and was a badge of Teutonic supremacy. The soil was ready to receive opinions contrary to the ecclesiastical system, and nowhere did the heretical sects of the 13th century, the Bogomilians and Waldenses, take deeper root than in Bohemia. The reign of Charles IV, 1346 to 1378, forms a decisive epoch in Bohemian history. The Pfaffenkaiser, raised to the empire by the influence of the church, was bound to use his power in the church's behalf. Charles IV has been differently judged according to different conceptions of his duty. To the political theorist or reformer, who looked to the emperor to inspire Europe with a new spirit, Charles IV seemed an indolent and self-indulgent ruler. To the Germans, Charles IV seemed destitute of dignity, weak and incapable, a king who did not care to maintain his prerogatives against the encroachments of his nobles, but regarded Germany as a province annexed to Bohemia. It is true that Charles IV paid no heed to the empire and allowed Germany to go its own way. But he devoted himself to the interests of his Bohemian subjects, so that his reign is the golden age of their national annals. A model of a father to Bohemia, and a model of a stepfather to Germany, the Emperor Maximilian called him in later years. He made Prague, said an admirer, what Rome and Constantinople had been. He adorned his capital, elevated it into the seat of an archbishopric, and founded a university which soon took its place by the side of the great universities of Paris, Oxford, and Bologna. These steps of Charles IV, so far as they strengthened the organization of the church, increased the influence of the Germans. But besides increasing the power of the church, Charles IV's zeal led him to wish for a reform in the clergy, and round the cry for reform which Charles IV fostered, the national spirit of the Czechs slowly and unconsciously rallied. The church in Bohemia was wealthy and powerful. The Archbishop of Prague was lord of 329 towns and villages. The cathedral at Prague maintained 300 ecclesiastics. There were at least 110 convents in the land. Simony was rife, and as a consequence, negligence of duty, exaction, and corruption of manners prevailed among the clergy. A visitation held in 1379 convicted of immorality 16 clergymen out of 30 who were visited. Charles IV and the Archbishop Ernest of Paardebuck were anxious to restore the zeal and morality of the Bohemian clergy. Charles's reforming zeal led him to summon from Austria an earnest preacher, Conrad of Waldhausen, who came to Prague in 1360 and began to denounce pride, luxury, and avarice with such effect that crowds thronged to his preaching, and showed the power of his words by returning to simplicity of life. Conrad was led to ask himself how it was that he succeeded where the ordinary ministrations of the clergy failed. His meditations led him to attack the simony and other vices of the clergy, and especially of the friars. It was in vain that the clergy accused Conrad of heresy. The king and the archbishop upheld him against their attacks, and it is by the irony of fate that in his zeal for the purity of the Bohemian church, the Orthodox king set on foot a movement which involved his son in bloody war against his people and made Bohemia a hotbed of heresy. The earnestness of Conrad of Waldhausen raised up followers, chief of whom was Milich of Kramierich in Moravia, who in 1363 set aside his canonry at Prague to devote himself to the work of preaching to the poor. The teaching of Conrad had only been addressed to the Germans, but Milich preached in the Bohemian language, and by his fiery mysticism appealed to the imagination of the people. He expounded prophecy and terrified his hearers by his denunciations. The tone of his preaching became more mystical, and the visions of the apocalypse filled his imagination. One day his zeal carried him so far that, preaching before Charles IV, he denounced him as Antichrist. But the emperor forgave him, and when he was accused of heresy and appealed to Pope Urban V in 1367, Charles warmly recommended him to the Pope. Mielich went to Rome, but while waiting for the Pope's return, affixed a notice to the door of St. Peter's that he was ready to prove in a sermon the speedy coming of Antichrist. For this, he was imprisoned. But Urban V, on his arrival, released him and treated him kindly. Mielich returned to Prague, justified against his accusers, but ceased afterwards to preach about Antichrist. His saintly character impressed all who came near him, and he was the consoler of many troubled hearts. The wonders wrought by his preaching and the growing number of converts who laid aside their evil courses and submitted themselves to his guidance soon kindled the jealousy of the clergy, who again denounced him as a heretic to the Pope. The charges against him were chiefly his preaching of the Antichrist, his abuse of the clergy, disregard of excommunication, and excessive puritanism in several points. He was summoned to Avignon by Gregory XI and died there in 1374. Mielich had succeeded in kindling the imagination and awakening the religious enthusiasm of the Bohemians. By his words and by his actions, he had set before them a lofty idea of personal holiness and purity. He was, says one of his followers, the image and son of our Lord Jesus Christ, the express similitude of his apostles. He quickened religious zeal, deepened men's grasp on spiritual truth, and left behind him a band of devoted followers bent on walking in his steps. But what he had expressed in the form of mysticism, in stirring appeals to men's feelings, his followers, chief amongst them Matthias of Janov and Thomas Stitney, worked out in their writings into dogmatic forms. Matthias of Janov was not so much a preacher as a theologian, and in his work, De Regulis Veteris et Novi Testamenti, drew out from the Bible alone, disregarding the works of the fathers and the traditions of the Church, the rules of a holy and Christian life. He insisted upon the sufficiency of the Scriptures. He urged the need of having Christ in the heart and not merely on the lips. He dwelt upon the danger of ceremonies in hiding from men's eyes the sufficiency of Christ as the sole Redeemer, who suffices for the salvation of all who believe in him. In urging these conclusions, Matthias had no consciousness of a breach with the existing ecclesiastical system, but he nonetheless struck blows against it, which sapped its hold upon the minds of men. Matthias, however, wrote in Latin, and so addressed himself only to the more educated and intelligent. Thomas of Stitney, a Bohemian nobleman, followed in the steps of Mielich and wrote for the Bohemian people. In clear and simple language, he carried home to men's minds the same truths as Matthias insisted upon: the need of faith founded on the Word of God, showing itself in good works, and not resting on ceremonial observances. This spiritual movement in Bohemia would have died away, as so many others had done, if it had not found in the University of Prague an organized body which gave it stability and force. Founded in 1348, the University of Prague, under the fostering care of Charles IV, rapidly increased in importance, so that in 1372 it counted 4,000 students. Its constitution was a matter of some difficulty, and the faculties of theology and jurisprudence strove for supremacy, till in 1372 the jurists formed themselves into a separate university. Following the example of Paris, the University of Prague divided itself into four nations: Bohemian, Bavarian, Saxon, and Polish. At the end of the 14th century, the foundation of the universities of Krakow, Vienna, Heidelberg, Köln, and Erfurt in some degree diminished the importance of Prague, but it still remained the chief center of intellectual life among the Germans and Slavonic peoples. The Poles, however, were few in number, and their vote was practically exercised by the Germans of Silesia. The Czechs found themselves in a minority in the university which had been founded in their behalf, and the struggle of nationalities which prevailed throughout Bohemia raged fiercely in academic matters. The Czechs claimed exclusive possession of the colleges, which, as elsewhere, were foundations to encourage research. Their claims were supported by King Wenzel, who, with all his failings, was true to the Bohemian people, and by their help maintained himself upon the throne. We may gather from Wenzel's conduct to the Archbishop, John of Jenstein, how slight was the hold which the clergy had upon the popular favor. How deep was the impression produced by the reforming preachers. John of Jenstein was made Archbishop of Prague in 1378 because he had won Wenzel's favor by his pleasant manners and skill in the chase. The story of Becket and Henry II was almost reproduced. A change came over the archbishop. He became a rigid ascetic, and his new sense of duty brought him into frequent collisions with the king. The quarrel came to a crisis in 1393, when John of Jenstein hastened to fill up the vacant abbacy of Clonruby, though he knew that the king was applying to the pope to suppress it for the purpose of founding a new bishopric. Wenzel's wrath was ungovernable. He summoned John to Prague and passionately ordered him and three of his followers to be seized and imprisoned. Two of them were tortured, and Wenzel ordered all of them to be drowned. But when his rage passed away, he bethought himself of the consequences which might follow from drowning an archbishop, and reluctantly ordered his prisoners to be released. One of them, John of Pomuk, was so severely injured by the torture that his life was hopeless, and Wenzel ordered him to be thrown into the Moldau. Archbishop John was driven to humble himself before Wenzel. He met with no support from the clergy or the people, and at last fled to Rome, where Boniface IX refused to take any steps that might lead to a quarrel with Wenzel, from whom at that time he looked for help in Italy. John was driven to resign his archbishopric and died in Rome in 1400. That Wenzel should with impunity and success offer such violence to the metropolitan of the Bohemian Church is a striking evidence that the clergy were looked upon with indifference, if not with dislike. The death of John of Pomuk caused no commotion in Bohemia. The University of Prague showed no desire to interfere in the quarrel between Wenzel and the archbishop. Hus was accused afterwards of openly expressing his approval of the murder of John of Pomuk. His answer that he only said that the drowning or imprisoning of a priest was no reason for putting the kingdom under interdict shows that he certainly made no protest or raised his voice against Wenzel's conduct. It is a curious point in later history that this John of Pomuk was chosen by the Jesuits to supplant the memory of Hus as a martyr in the minds of the Bohemians. But legend gathered round John's history. He was confused with a confessor of Wenzel's queen and was said to have been thrown into the Moldau because he refused to violate the secrets of the confessional at the bidding of a jealous and tyrannical husband. The legend took root in Bohemia in the dark days of the Catholic reaction, and the imaginary confessor was canonized in 1729 under the name of St. John Nepomuken. He answered his purpose in providing Bohemia with a national saint and in substituting a more poetical martyr for John Hus, who was only burnt at the stake for his theological opinions. There were in Bohemia, at the end of the 14th century, many political elements which favored a revolutionary movement. There was an ill-concealed jealousy of the Czechs against the German middle classes, which tended to combine with the Puritan movement against the abuses of the clergy. The rising of the German nobles against Wenzel, and the pretensions of Rupert to replace him in the empire, identified his cause still more strongly with that of the Czech nationality. In the University of Prague, the reforming party became similarly identified with the Czechs, who were striving to maintain their privileges against the Germans. Soon a new impulse and a more definite form was given to the energies of the reformers by the spread in the University of Prague of the writings of Wycliffe. The keen, clear criticisms of ecclesiastical dogmas, which had not taken root in England because they were associated with no national or political interest, supplied a form to the religious aspirations which were in Bohemia associated with a widespread popular movement. The connection between Bohemia and England, which followed on Richard II's marriage with Wenzel's sister Anne, increased the natural intercourse which existed in those days between universities. From Oxford, the writings of Wycliffe were brought to Prague as early as 1385 by Jerome of Prague, who was himself a student at Oxford. The questions which they raised, especially the question of transubstantiation, were eagerly discussed by an increasing party in the university, of whom John Huss became the chief representative. End of section 35. Read by Pamela Nagami, M.D., in Encino, California, August 2023. End of the History of the Papacy, From the Great Schism to the Sack of Rome, Volume 1, by Mandel Creighton.